and their advantages, and they're not yet popular, but the man we were talking to was predicting they are going to become more popular. So we haven't heard the last of batteries. There's a lot more to the story. We're all demanding more and more power and more friendly characteristics in a smaller and smaller package. I think Glenn was the next person, KC2QIQ. I know he's designed all kinds of charging networks for batteries, among other things. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out with the lithium ion, whether it's the iron, some of the other phosphates, the properties of the battery are very, very similar. And they pretty much operate the same. I mean, there's some cost-effective things depending on which country you're buying it from and who has what available to them, but don't believe that one is more rugged than the other, and or the battery that's in the Tesla is any more superior than the one that's in your cell phone. and I don't mean that as a joke, being quite serious. When you look at the individual cell of a lithium-ion battery, in other words, a 1.5-volt cell, which can be charged as high as 2.4 volts depending on the temperature, and it can be discharged as low as about 0.8 volts. The whole key to that is as long as you keep the battery within that voltage range and keep the currents within five times the maximum current. So in other words, if you have an 1100 milliamp battery, which is 1.1 amps, and you don't charge it with or discharge it more than 5 amps at a time, the battery is extremely rugged. But no matter whether you charge or discharge, the key thing is always to keep the battery within that range, voltage range, and keep the currents between 0 and 5 amps on a 1.1 amp battery. So they're very, very important things to look at. And what happens many times when you let it drop, the reason for many of these failures are that the manufacturer of the charger ignores, for cost reason or one other reason, many of the modes of the battery. They just ignore and say, ah, that probably won't ever happen in the lifetime of the product. Unfortunately, if it does, the batteries in that lithium-ion structure can become quite dangerous. Fire, explosion, many things have happened. At sea level, fire is probably the biggest thing you have to worry about. At altitude, one of the last things in the world you ever want to have at altitude is a lithium-ion battery, as Boeing has found out just recently, actually. They can be quite explosive at altitude. If you have lithium-ion batteries and you're going to go on a flight, make sure that wherever that battery is located, that you're inside the pressurized part of the cabin. You never want to put one and say, you know something, I'm going to put the battery inside the luggage compartment. The luggage compartment in the plane may not be at the same pressure as the cabin. So that's something to really worry about. If you have laptops, cell phones, things like that, and you're at altitude, your best bet is to turn them off, number one. And really, number two, is don't store them inside an area that's non-pressurized when the plane is at altitude. KC2QIQ.
Comment about that pressurization in 1YDY.
Yeah, I'm going to go to N1YDY in a minute. I know that the door on the baggage compartment of every airliner is a sealed door maintaining pressure. And for the baggage compartment, if you said the baggage compartment is not being maintained at the right temperature, I'm going to agree. But when it comes to pressure, I'm now envisioning what would happen if the cargo compartment was unpressurized and above that on the flat floor are the passengers and there and it is pressurized. You now would be exerting a huge force on the floor of the aircraft, and I think it is not constructed for that. And when YDY, bring us up to news, up to speed on this, K2RIW.
Dick, you basically addressed what I wanted to comment on. No aircraft operated commercially today. Differential pressure between the luggage. In fact, most of any airplane you're likely to get on will have a type of popping. Equal. There is, however, a possibility of a difference in temperature. Nothing gets below 42 degrees, 6 degrees Celsius, on any aircraft that you're likely to be on in the free world. But other than that, I think you've pretty much covered everything. So It'll get colder. Most aircraft are the ones where they allow a pet to ride because they're maintained at a more temperate level, but the rear passenger, I'm sorry, the rear luggage compartments are not temperature regulated directly, but everything is pressurized at the same level. N1YDY.
Thank you, William. Good information. And I believe you are a pilot. Is that true, Bill?
First, it's Hank. And second, yeah, that's what I was doing, before, you know, when I was working. Not working now, but when I was, that was my livelihood.
So we're getting it from the horse's mouth. Okay, good information. So, as I see it, Paul, lithium battery, if you're going to store it for a long period of time, don't leave it at 100%. You and I usually charge our batteries and go and use them right away, so that's probably not a problem. But I think it's worth spending the time to find out the particular charger that you're using with your particular purchased piece of equipment. Is it the intelligent kind of charger that keeps it within the right voltage range, within the right current range, and knows how to top off at the end? If there are multiple cells, is it sharing the voltage between the cells? There's quite a few factors to worry about if you want to get the best possible life, performance, and safety out of your lithium polymer batteries, which we're all going to be using more of. And as time goes on, I can tell these guys who are flying radio control battery-operated model airplanes, they've been there on the front lines of this problem for the last 5 or 10 years. They've developed a lot, and an awful lot of that's going to eventually end up in our handheld radio equipment. I'm always a little disappointed. Let me drop it.
I have a question, N1YDY.
I'll go with you in a second, Bill. I'm always disappointed when I find out that... forgot this great statement I was going to make. I'll pass it over to Bill until I think of it. N1YDY. Oh, yes. The fact that many of our cell phones do not have a replaceable battery. If I was going out in the field, I'm going to go on a long hike in the woods somewhere, so to speak. I'd like to have a pocket full of charged batteries that I can plug into the cell phone one at a time. And many of our more modern-day cell phones are so busy making the styling of the cell phone so great and thin and particular shapes and whatever, there's no longer a way of disconnecting the battery and plugging in a new one. So, yeah, hopefully they gave you a charging plug off to the side that you can use somehow with an external battery. There's ways around it, but they haven't been helping us. N1YDY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, when this conversation is over, my quick question is, why, when we see lithium-ion application guides for motorcycles, which are now becoming quite popular, also, are they recommending a lower ampere-hour fitment than what the bike originally came with? In other words, a lot of motorcycles come with, say, a 17 or 18 ampere-hour battery, and they're typically recommending something in the 10 to 12-hour lithium-ion replacement level, and I'm just wondering why that might be. N1YDY.
A darn good question. And each time I go to Sears Roebuck to buy a new battery for my automobile, and they'll say, what kind of a car you got? And you look it up, and they say, you're going to use battery number so-and-so. And you buy battery number so-and-so, and it's two-thirds the size of the original battery. It doesn't fill up the whole case, the whole space allocated for the battery in the automobile. What I do in each one of those cases, I measure the size of the battery. I look at everything on their shelf. Sometimes it might be a Land Rover battery that has the right size, and it's got a zillion ampere hours, so to speak. And I say, I'm buying that battery. And I say, what car have you got? And I say, I will not tell you. You're going to sell me that battery. I've done that on a number of occasions, and I get what I want. I don't know why in the world they want you to put some tiny little thing in there. Maybe because they just like selling that particular model to have a higher profit margin. True guesses on my part. So there's a lot more to it, Paul. You've asked a darn good question. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. And a lot of comments on that. I mean, 25 years ago, we used to discuss the Nikon batteries, but we haven't discussed the newer technology batteries as much. And it just bothers me that the same holds true for the tablets. I can't get the... There's no way you're going to take the battery out. when you call up, they tell you it's not replaceable. You know, if you want a different battery, you got to send it into them, and they'll take the thing apart and do whatever they got to do. And that's exactly what I was thinking about. Well, you know, you're gonna kill this battery, you know, if you don't do what you're supposed to do in the directions. And when you call them up, directions, they don't tell you anything about charging or recharging the battery. Plug it in, basically, and that's it. They do tell you bring it up to a charge when you first, you know, full charge when you first get it. When you call them up and try to get an answer from them, they tell you to unplug it after you get it to 100%. Now, what Chris said is interesting. You know, I'll go by that. You get up to 100%, don't leave it there. That was interesting. I never thought about that. Well, follow those basic rules. Unplug it when you get to 100%, don't leave it there, and don't leave it on a low charge as well. And as far as charging, multiple cells, I wouldn't be surprised if this tablet is, I looked up on the internet, I think these lithium polymer cells could go up to 4.2 volts, that's that high. And nowadays, you know, all the IC circuits today, I think you could run some of these things. I wouldn't be surprised if this thing's running on 3 volts instead of, you know, it used to be everything was 5 volts, you know. I think that might have all changed. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's only one cell in this whole thing. Even so, it's a 4,000 milliamp hour battery. Well, we'll see. Thanks for all the comments. Dick, back to you.
The hardest thing in the world to disassemble is a tablet. And sometimes they're made with an ironclad case. There's one human being I know of who has disconnected, who has disassembled his tablet in order to do repairs inside. If Chris is still with us, he's going to tell us a little bit about how easy it is or difficult it is to get in there if you wanted to at some later time change the battery, because you don't want to give up on your favorite tablet just because the battery dies. KB2IQN, if you're still there. K2IW, the TechNet. Yeah, it looks like Chris, he was mobile, and I think he reached touchdown. We'll get back to that subject. I'm hearing somebody else on the input who wasn't coming through the machine. Who was that? Okay, we've got two people left. Steve, who are keeping waiting. I hope he's not falling asleep by all this jazz. And John. John signed it first. KC2WGB. Go ahead and help with your question, John. K2IW in the TechNet.
We got KC2SLDS at the low end, up until maybe 1.5 gig, it's only 41, 42 dB. Why should there be such a discrepancy in that? You got any ideas? Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you a couple of questions because there's a little bit of an ambiguity there. It's rated 1.2, 1 to 2 gigs. Straight through Utopia, it had good characteristics from 820 to 2.2 gigs. Were you talking about its input S11 reflection coefficient? Were you talking about the 30 dB coupling coefficient, that it was really supplying 30 dB of coupling across that range? That wasn't clear. Then when you went to the reverse mode, 2 to 2.2 gigs, you saw 48 dB of coupling. That's 18 dB lower than 30. That was a supply that would suggest 18 dB of directivity. Since it's outside of the frequency range where it's rated 1 to 2, the fact that the coupling directivity degraded to 18 dB is not bad. So I know there's more to your question. I might not have gotten it all. So is it directivity you're trying to confirm? Standing wave ratio you're trying to confirm? Performance forward and reverse? Give us a few more words on that, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Okay. The signal is being transmitted from the coupled port to the analyzer. I have an RF signal going into the input port, a dummy load on the output port. There I get beautifully a flat line at 30 dB. When I reverse the dummy load and the input signal, I get a varying decibel line. It's not a straight line. At the extreme end, I'm down to 48 dB, but at the lower frequency end, I'm only getting like 41, 42 dB. And there's a couple of ripples in there, but that's basically the slant. Why should there be a 6 dB difference just from the direction? Shouldn't that be as smooth as the other direction?
In general, the answer is absolutely not. Glad you got into this one. If I had a 30 dB directional coupler that's meeting good manufacturing specification, it's not a high-performance one, it's not an instrument-grade one, but it's a good performance one, manufacturing-grade, I'm going to call it. The forward coupling, 30 dB down, is going to be extremely flat, and when you go very far beyond and you plot a DC to light, so to speak, you would see that that flat region is really a rectified sine wave looking waveform. Full wave rectified sine wave is what it's going to look like. However, reverse coupling, which is directivity, which is, let's call it isolation. Let me drop it. There's nothing in the world to tell you that the isolation has to be a flat curve as long as the curve is lower than the specification. If the specification is 18, let's round off the numbers 20. If the specification is 20 decibels of directivity, all that says is that a 30 dB forward coupler will be 20 dB lower. 20 dB lower than 30 is 50. It'll never be any stronger than minus 50 in the reverse mode through the rated frequency region, 1 to 2 gigs. If somewhere in that region where you want it to be more than 20 dB of directivity, more than 50 dB total down, if it happened to hit 60, 70, or 80, which would represent higher directivity, that's desirable. The fact that it's an uneven curve in the isolation, as long as it meets the spec, that's better. You don't want that curve to be flat. You want that curve to be as low as possible. If it hits some dips of minus 50, minus 60, minus 70, that's a fantastic unit. So in directivity, you don't seek flatness. You seek a minimum directivity, and hopefully it's more than that. Does that make a little more sense, John? Good question. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, I was just wondering, because a 6 dB different, when the linearity looks beautiful within the spec in the forward motion, in the forward plan, when I reverse it, I notice a big difference. So, all right, let's say 18, maybe it's supposed to be a 50 dB isolation. But at the lower end, including the rated part of 1.2, 1.3 gig, it is only 41 and 42. So I thought it should be 18 at least from 1 gig to 2 gig, and it's not.
AC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. Okay, there's two things to worry about here. Was there a partial failure of the directional coupler? Maybe this is one of the situations where you want to take it apart because it's abused. And are you sure that the dummy load you're using really has a S11 that gets down to those low numbers? When you start testing very high performance directional couplers, you could have a directional coupler like I own one that has instrumentation grade 50 dB of directivity. And unless you're using a dummy load, where all the reflections from the dummy load are not 50 dB down, you put it on a 30 dB down dummy load, and you'll think the directional coupler is failing the spec. So try a couple of other dummy loads of high quality before you judge it to be in error. And then if you do confirm that error, it's time to open it up and find out what's rattling around in there, if you know what I mean. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
I was just going to suggest to John that what he had seen and what he's measured is not uncommon. And that's very, very typical of what I call long directional couplers. Many of the problems that he's looking at get, in other words, that slope in the directivity looks better in dual directional couplers than it does in single directional coupler. And also, the other thing is typically the stubby or the very, very short directional couplers, the forward and the reverse directivity are closer in match in terms of bandwidth. It's very, very interesting. I've designed tons of directional couplers. As a matter of fact, I've got two NARDAs sitting right in front of me right now that I was just looking at, and the directivity and the flatness directivity, really a lot of it has to do with the quality of the 50-ohm load on the coupled line and the length of the line between the two ports. In other words, what is the distance between port 1 and port 2? Because that's giving a function of how close the directivity or the direct coupling of that port to that printed line. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. Good information. Glenn, I'm going to ask you a really crazy question. What's your kitty cat's name?
That's Hurricane Sandy. The funny part is we named her Sandy. She was born about 4 months before the hurricane. We named her Sandy. Then the hurricane hit. But that is the loudest cat I've ever heard in my whole life. I've never had a cat that loud, Dick. I mean, she's crying from like the other half of the house just because I'm not paying attention to her for a couple of minutes. KC2QIQ.
Late check.
She's learned how to get attention. Well done. We've got a couple of cats, too, and they do something similar from time to time. So as you can see here, John, directivity doesn't have to be flat. You got to be careful of how high in quality is your dummy load when you're doing the test. And it doesn't make sense at first, I know. And where it's got such a beautiful flat curve in the forward coupling, you would think there would be a beautiful flat curve in the reverse coupling. When you're looking for isolation, by the same token, if I'm measuring the standing wave ratio of a really good antenna, and I want the standing wave ratio to be better than 1.5 to 1. Let me drop.
By the way, I got a message for Glenn from Roberto in Telesco. He said, get a bandpass filter for your cat.
Not a chance in the world. That cat is giving out sounds that are right in the middle of the audio bandpass of his microphone. So we're going to hear it. By the way, I'm wearing earphones, Glenn. That cat sound was much, much lower than your voice. Not to worry. Many other people didn't hear it. What I'm getting at now is I'm testing my antenna. My antenna is rated for a 1.5 standing wave ratio, worst case. I forget the exact number, but I think it's minus 15 dB. So I'm sweeping the antenna, and I'm looking at reverse power. I'm looking at reflected power. It's called S11 on a vector network analyzer. You and I would call it a... There's two or three different ways of displaying standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio is real numbers on a graph. That's one way. The more sophisticated way is decibels of reverse power. Okay? So I want the reverse power reflected off the antenna to always be minus 15 dB or better. And if it had a couple of spikes that hit minus 30, minus 40, minus 50, that's a better antenna, even though that curve looks bumpy as all hell. You'd be amazed how many people look at that bumpy curve of reflected power and they think it represents an error or something that's wrong with the antenna. The lower the number, the better, and even if it's got spikes going lower, the better. So directivity doesn't have to be anywhere near flat. In the really well-tuned devices, it's anything but flat. I wonder if that helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2QAQ with one more comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
I was just going to mention, you know, while I'm listening to all of this, I have two couplers that I keep on forgetting the numbers of them, and I brought them out mainly because I know John is playing a lot with couplers right now, and there are two NARTA couplers that, in my opinion, every ham should have. Every ham that's serious about measuring power in VSWR should really get, and it's the NARTA 3022 and the NARTA 3020. These are two beautiful dual-directional couplers. You can find them on eBay for, like, about $100 a piece. But I'll tell you, these are the two most valuable pieces of equipment you'll probably ever have in your shack. They're basically 20 dB couplers on either side, the dual-directional couplers. The 20 goes from 50 megahertz to roughly about a gigahertz, and the 22 goes from 1 to 4. But these are really, really beautiful couplers. They cover pretty much most of the whole VHF and UHF part of the ham band stick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Cotter is one of the brand names that I really favor. They've been making directional couplers since the year one. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they make an awful lot of these things with a blue package with a red label on them. And when you see them at a flea market, buy them. Don't worry about the fact that the frequency range on the label is wrong compared to you. Just as long as the frequency range is higher than you care about, buy it. If you want a good directional coupler for 144 megs, the thing in front of you says it's good for 1 to 2 gigs, buy it. Read the article that's on Mike number 2's website, technetlimoc.com, the article by K2RIW on using directional couplers for power measurement and for wave ratio measurements. Okay, let's see, what am I doing here? All right, yeah, I think I figured that out. You read that article, it'll tell you how to use them way outside of the frequency range, as long as you're using them at lower frequency. They fall off in a very predictable manner, and yet they're giving you a lot of high-quality information. As you guys have heard for the last two or three weeks, on and off, John and I and others have been discussing directional couplers. Let me drop. Directional couplers, and let's call them signal couplers in general. It's an area that has been very poorly covered in any of our amateur radio literature, radio amateurs handbook. The closest they come is that they'll show you how to build a homebrew standing wave ratio indicator, which is a dual directional coupler, but they don't make that super clear as to how it works and why it's so valuable. I know we've kept you waiting an awful long time, Steve. I hope you're still with us. KC2MDP, K2LIW in the tech man.
An additional question on that coupler, Dick.
Let me see if Steve is still there. Steve, are you still there? Okay, now that we found that the Steve is not there, we can take our own sweet time with as many questions as you like on directional couplers. Go right ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, all of my 50-ohm loads that I put on there, they're all metric quality, and I've tried several of them, exact same waveform. So that's not the issue. But I have a question for you and Glenn. Now, Glenn said linearity looks better on a dual-directional coupler. Is that because of the balance of the inductive and capacitive loading because of the extra couple port? Is that why it's improved? What do you think, Dick?
I think the answer is no. It's not physics we're discussing here. When a company like NARTA or Hewlett-Packard decides to build a dual-directional coupler in one package, for reasons that are not so obvious, they put a hell of a lot more effort into that design. To know the person is really looking simultaneously at forward power, reverse power, for all we know that those two detected waveforms are going to go into some fancy logic that calculates standing wave ratio or reverse power ratios or whatever. So they seem to put more effort into dual directional couplers. It's not a slap together design. It's something that they spend more time. The physics of making a single directional coupler have high directivity is not any different than a dual directional coupler having flat response and high directivity. In either case, either a dual or a single, you could have the flattest forward curve. By the way, by way of the stepped design, there's various ways you can make a dual that you can make a single directional coupler cover a lot more than an octave. They usually cover almost an octave or a little bit beyond. You can make them cover decades and multiple decades if the coupled line is built in a staircase-like manner. And one of the places where you can read about that design is out of Hall and Howe's book. Hall and Howe, H-O-W-E, way back in the dark ages of 1975, wrote a book called Strip Line Techniques, and I think it's in its second or third edition by now. I didn't say it's a super easy book read. It's very well illustrated, and it tells you everything you want to know on the subject of all kinds of hybrids and couplers built in the strip line manner. You study that book and you'll find out everything you want to know on this subject. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Okay. Yeah, I just thought it was unusual, and I've seen those spikes that you're talking about, and yes, it's better, but it's only at that particular frequency where you will put your marker that antenna will give you that response. Yeah, that I understand. Okay, I'll pick up the next, and then we'll go to the mailbag after you complete. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Even those negative going spikes of better directivity might not fall on your exact favorite frequency. That's not a showstopper. Again, that article on using directional couplers, it's on Mike Number Two's site, technetlimoc.com, and there's a K2RIW article. He'll tell you in that article how to use an external tuning-like device or gimmicking-like device that you add to your directional coupler during your measurements, and at your favorite frequency, you can make the directivity as deep as you want. If you want 55 dB of directivity, it's a fairly simple tuning procedure. If you add a external double stub tuner, double slug tuner, or the right kind of network with the screws that go into the transmission line, if you know what I mean, particularly this waveguide. So, I think we've gone through that one with you once before. Is that true, John? How you can make any directional coupler on your favorite frequency, at least in that near frequency region, you can make the directivity as high as you like by a simple tuning procedure once you understand the physics of what's going on. KC2WGB for any comment. K2LIW the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, that's very true, and there's a lot of interesting reading all over the place on these directional couplers. And you're right, not too many people are using them, but I'm getting more queries on what they can be used for. So evidently the TechNet is stirring up some interest in them, and maybe the prices are going to rise. I've got about 25 of them now.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Poor John, he's down to his last 25 directional couplers. KC2QAQ, the leader of Hurricane Sandy. Go ahead, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, hopefully I caught it right now in a null mode, at least for the time being. But I was just going to mention that, you know, a lot of the equipment that John is using and the equipment that I use here, we're using network analyzers that are very, very broad band. And in some of these bands with some of these couplers that you can use, there is an advantage to having very, very flat couplers, in other words, over a wide frequency range instead of, I mean, certainly if you're just, you know, using like your favorite frequency like you measured, you can virtually get away with almost any coupler at that point in time and kind of fudge it up and get the measurements that you're looking for, and with very good accuracy, actually. But the thing is, when you have equipment like some of the stuff that John and I have, and you want to look at swept measurements, in other words, you want to use a sweep generator, and you want to look at things in broadband, there's nothing better than a flat coupler, Dick. It's just, you know, then you can start looking at things, you know, like you're saying, over an octave, and then look at graphs, you know, look at the graphical representation of the performance of your equipment. And that's where, you know, couplers like the Nardis that I was mentioning earlier are really worth their weight in gold. But there again, this is just an opinion of mine from practice, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Since so few guys that you and I, John, Glenn, and I can talk to have a fairly deep understanding, a warm, fuzzy feeling for directional couplers, my question is, where does the average enthusiastic guy, a passionate guy, where does he get directional coupler knowledge from? If by some magic somebody tells him, hey, this is good, study it, go to the websites that have the information. Yeah, that's one way a guy could find out about it. Way back in my third year of electrical engineering at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, I ran into a man named Harvey Glass. Suddenly realized what the value of these things is, and he started talking to me, and I started listening. Him and Hank Keane, the guy who basically invented strip line techniques way back in the late 50s, early 60s, these two guys were in the same department with me, experts in the area, lots of patents, and they started talking to me. They recognized the young pump engineer with enthusiasm, and they were willing to start taking him under their wing, and that's where I learned it from. Glenn, who introduced you to good directional couplers? What made you have the passion for these things? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, I guess early in the beginning, I didn't really have a lot of passion for them, but when I was working at Microwave Power Devices, initially I was hired there for power supply engineering, and I guess what happened was that when I got done, you know, developing and designing a whole bunch of power supplies for them, they were like, you know, we have this, you know, you want to work with RF for a while? And I was like, sure, I'd love to. And they're like, okay, we lost a person that was our combiner, divider, and coupler guy. You interested in taking on a couple of these projects? And I soon realized that I was designing couplers and dividers and everything because nobody else there wanted to do it, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, Glenn, is the opportunity made itself available to you, and you learned to swim by being thrown into the water in the rapids. What tech did you go to? A little bit of data was in reference data for radio engineers. A whole lot of data is in Holland Howe's book. How did you know where to go in those dark ages before the internet was really rolling to get the information you needed? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I looked up at that time, you know, places, because this is pre-internet. This is, I guess, you know, we're talking, I guess, 85, somewhere around that area. And I was looking, trying to find information on directional couplers, and just like you had mentioned, there wasn't around a lot around. There's much more today, especially with the internet. But at that time, I found that there's a company within walking distance of the Microwave Power Devices that was over on Osser Avenue that called NARDA on the other end of the street. So I made friends with quite a few of the RF engineers over at NARDA, and got quite a few tips from them, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Well done. That's the way to do it. I used to walk around the building and walk into the office of somebody that's an expert in a certain subject and start tapping his brain. And so when an engineer talks to an engineer, boy, does information pass. That's why a hell of a lot of companies make sure that when you call them on the telephone, you're able to talk to the personnel department and make sure that you don't talk to an engineer, because quite often the engineer will spill the beans and tell everybody everything. They're painfully honest at times. Well done. One more call for Steve. Let's see if he's come back. KC2MTP. Well, I know we had a question. K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Dick. Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I got a quick question for you. You can give me the super quick answer. I know we're pressed for time here. Basically, I have an antenna tuner. It's an old Tentec 229. It's a 2 kW antenna tuner. It goes from 160 to 10 meter. What are my chances of using that on 6 meters? Now, I'm only running about 450 watts on 6 meters. Do you think it'll work? And the antenna I'm going to be using is a G5 RV type antenna. Back to you.
I give you a 50-50 chance. And even if it comes out bad, there's a way to make it good. That antenna tuner is guaranteed by the manufacturer to give you some amount of reasonable correction up to, I'm going to pick a number, a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio of any phase angle. It'll handle it from 160 meters to 10 meters. Maybe that's its specification. And what you're really looking at is that if any one of those frequencies, you look at the area on the Smith chart where the thing will give you a match, you can fill in that area. And as you get further and further outside of that frequency region, the area of the Smith chart that it can fulfill gets smaller and smaller. However, even if your particular antenna, let me drop it, your particular antenna at 6 meters falls into the area of the chart where your antenna tuner cannot correct it. As you know, just by increasing the amount of feed line between your transmitter and that antenna, what you're doing is you're taking the exact same dot on the Smith chart, which is a certain number of centimeters from the center of the Smith chart. Taking that dot as if it is the pencil on a compass, and the sharp point of the compass is in the center of the Smith chart, and you're rotating the compass. You're drawing a circle. As you add feed line, you're drawing that circle. That circle is then going to intercept the good region where your antenna tuner can handle it. So even though it's not rated to go to 6 meters, guarantee it'll give you performance on 6 meters, and even if it falls in a bad area, you can make that fall into the good area by increasing the transmission line length. I give you, with that caveat, I give you a 90% chance you're going to be happy with what it does on 6 meters. There's even a chance you're going to find out you like what it does on 2 meters. Because whatever they've done inside there to make it low in insertion loss, low in series resistance of the coil, low in equivalent series resistance of the capacitors. That's a fancy way of saying they put a quality inductor and a quality capacitor in there, and it's all in a well-shielded box. By the time you've done all of that for the 2 kilowatt level on 80 through 10 meters, guarantee at the 150 watt level, you're going to love what it does on 6 meters, 2 meters, and it might even have some performance on 432. It's not the rated performance, but you know some of the tricks now as to how to do it, Steve. KC2MDP, as you do that, come back and let us know. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I greatly appreciate the information. Yes, I will definitely give it a try once I get the antenna set up there. I'll try it on 6. Heck, I'll even try it on 2 meters and 70 centimeters to see what happens. I appreciate the info. Thanks again.
Yeah, this is another one of those cases like you're at a flea market and you look at a directional coupler and it says 1 to 2 gigs and you're looking for something at 144 megs. And your first response is, gee, what I want and what's on the label is way out of the frequency region. That thing will work like that charm down there at 144. In the case of this antenna tuner, it's not quite as broadband as a directional coupler, but still, guarantee you can go beyond. And there's all kinds of tricks. Once you understand what an antenna tuner is doing, there isn't that much magic in there, if you know what I mean. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in tonight. So I know I did hear somebody who said late chicken, but that was an extremely noisy signal. Let's give him one more try. That person who said late chicken, give me a call letters, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. We're only 48 minutes late of our schedule, which we don't adhere to. We brag about the fact we don't adhere to it. We get hot and heavy subjects. We go with the flow. That's what you're hearing. You're hearing enthusiastic people. Why cut them off just because somebody said the clock said such and such? KC2WGB. Go ahead to the mailbag, John. K2IW, the tech man.
Okay, Dick. KC2WGB. By the way, Roberto in Guadalajara sent a message that this is the first time he's hearing about this conversation of couplers evidently, I know we speak about it a lot on the TechNet plus on the air, but any questions he has, I just want to, you know, send them in and we'll process them for him. Okay, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the first question.
Since it was the last 2 or 3 weeks that we've had some pretty deep discussions on directional couplers, if he goes to the website of Mike Number One, which is www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and plays back those recordings. Although sometimes the recordings are a little bit noisy, the information is there, so he can be brought up to speed. Back to you, John, K2LIW.
GZ2WGB. Okay, have a ham here who's investigating buying a radio, and he's heard about roofing filters. He'd like to know what they are and what they're used for. He seems to be confused about the purpose of the word roofing filters. Maybe you could fill him in on that, Dick, and well, that'll start off with a good question. KC2WGB, back to you.
I think I have only partial understanding of the word roofing filter. I'll tell you what little information I've gathered. You guys can correct me where I'm wrong. We're talking about single and double conversion receivers, modern-day high-performance transceiver-like equipment, which is running by the super heterodyne technique. That's a fancy way of saying the RF comes in through an RF filter, goes to an RF amplifier, goes into a mixer. The mixer builds it, converts it down to the first IF. Your particular radio, maybe the very first IF is 8.5 megahertz, for instance. And you go through a bunch of stages of IF amplification at 8.5 megahertz, followed by your product detector, if it's a sideband receiver, followed by the audio amplifier, and out of the loudspeaker of your phones comes the audio. Can we drop? Now, if you want the highest possible dynamic range, particularly for off-channel signals. In other words, right now you're tuned to 7.2 megahertz, and this is during a field day operation, and the next tent 50 feet away, for whatever reason, he's operating on 7.25 when you're on 7.20, and he's blasting away with a kilowatt, and you're trying to listen to a weak signal at 7.20 in my particular example. The quality of that very first filter at 8.5 megahertz after that very first mixer can make an awful big difference as to how strong a nearby signal you can tolerate before the receiver starts going bonkers, starts exceeding dynamic range and giving you further intermodulation distortion and all kinds of saturation characteristics and birdies and so on. So the quality of that very first filter is part of what I think the so-called roofing filter is. You put some dollars into that very first filter, so at the beginning of the IF strip only sees the desirable signal at 7.2 megahertz that you're tuned to, and has a lot of rejection of 7.25 in my example. That can give you a great advantage. That's my light understanding of what a so-called roofing filter can do. Why don't you guys correct me on this one? Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Glenn's got a lot of explanation for it.
I see if Glenn is there.
I'm here, Dick, but I must have missed the question. What was the question? Sorry, KC2QIQ.
Okay, the question really is, what is a roofing filter? Why is it so valuable? How does it do what it does? So the word roofing filter is what the question John got in the mailbag. You got it, Glenn.
Well, I can explain what the roofing filter is in, like, in my Yaesu equipment. Like, I've got the FTGX 9000 over here, and what the filter is it's an FFT filter. It's basically a digitally sampling filter that allows you to narrow. Basically, you can either it allows you to adjust the passband. So in other words, you have, without a crystal filter, the crystal filter usually has like a cutoff in a certain passband, where this has a fully adjustable passband. So in other words, you can control the slope and the bandwidth of the filter. So if you want to really narrow it up and make it nice and narrow, and you can do it, and you can offset it, so like you can kind of like cut off one side, the lower frequency a little bit more, or the higher side of the frequency a little bit more, so you can basically really tailor the filter with basically dialing in knobs and control the skirt and the slope of the filter around the frequency you want to receive. Hopefully I'm describing it well enough, I think. KC2QIQ.
Glenn, there could be a little bit of confusion here. What you're describing is a very valuable filter done by FFT's Fast Fourier Transform. It falls under the category of digital signal processing. By digital signal processing, of the signal that comes out of the last stage, usually, the product detector. And you do an INQ product detection and put that into a digital signal processor. You can get some very fancy filtering functions of what came through the IF bandpass. However, if the front ends of the receiver was saturated with strong local nearby frequency signals and they're rolling through the IF strip, for the digital signal processor and the FFT to operate on that correctly is kind of difficult. It is my belief that the roofing filter is, in most cases, an analog filter, real inductor capacitor-like thing, which is right after the very first mixer, trying to give you the sharpest possible filtering you can get for the IF strip right up front, before all of those later stages of gain, where that saturating signal can give you grief. So I think the roofing filter is a high-quality, usually analog filter, placed right at the mixer. I may be wrong on this one, but you can see why I think that's the usual definition of a roofing filter. Over to you, Glenn, for a rebuttal, if you like. KC2QIQ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
You might be right, Dick, but I guess it's just the way that Yaesu labels them. In other words, by looking at the operator's manual on my FTPX9000, what they call the roofing filter in the instruction manual is the FFT filter, which that's the one that allows you to adjust the skirts on both sides. Then there's another filter called a mu tuner, and that's an inductive tuner very, very close to the front end I think that's in the IF also. I don't think that there's anything adjustable in my in this FTDX 9000. Although I know that they call one the analog tuning, the new tuning, and the roofing filter, it is in the IF stick. I know it's not in the front end for sure, but that's what Yaesu is calling it. So I'm not sure that maybe there's a more purist definition of it that you're actually referring to. K2IW, K2QIQ.
How recognized? To my knowledge, the so-called roofing filter is something you can turn on or turn off, install or don't install, but I don't think it's usually tunable. It's in the very first stage of the IF amplification after the mixer, I believe. Let's see what Hal's got to say. K6DPZ, K2LAW, the TechNet. Yeah, I think Hal is on a handy-talkie. He's at a remote site. I heard him in there briefly, but I think he might not be in there now because of his location. So as you can tell, we're not completely sure on this one, John. A little more research is required. I'll bet you if we Googled the word roofing filter, and by the way, each individual brand name, Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, and whatever, they're going to say different words as to what it is, how valuable it is, how they're using it, how it gets integrated as you go into certain modes of the receiver. The roofing filter, if it can be turned on and turned off, has its value. My guess is you tend not to use a roofing filter if you're going to be using a pan adapter, for instance, where you want to look at a whole lot of megacycles above and below where you're tuned. There you want very broadband, whereas the roofing filter, I think, is a high-quality, narrowband, quite often analog filter, is my belief, but I'm willing to be suggested to correct it on this one. More to follow on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
VDH with a comment.
Okay, Mr. VDH, go right ahead. I know I should know you. Start with your name, sir.
this is the call is WA2BDH, and the name is John. Just a comment on the roofing filter. I have an older receiver. It's a Japan Radio Company NRD515. Basically tunes 100 kilohertz to 30 megahertz. The first IF in it up converts. They come in and they up convert to a 70.455 megahertz. The front end has a right coming in from the antenna. There are essentially seven filters. I just have the spec sheet here. They break down the range from 100 kilohertz to 30 megahertz. The first filter is essentially a 600 kilohertz low-pass filter. The second filter covers the broadcast band. The third filter, 1.6 to 3 megs, then 3 to 5, 5 to 9, 9 to 17, and then 17 to 30. Each of these filters is selected by pin diodes as you tune the bands, and the receiver essentially band switches in 1 megahertz segments. I hope that gives some information. They do call them roofing filters in the Japan Radio Company manual. Go ahead.
WA2TTT. TTT recognized. Japan Radio may have called them roofing filters. They sound more like RF bandpass filters to me. And RF bandpass and roofing filters, I think, are usually different. And so I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that there could be a little bit of difference in definition of roofing filter from one brand to another and one time to another. What they called a roofing filter in 1990 and what they call a roofing filter today could be a little bit different. W2TTT, you got it, Gordon. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and everybody else. I'm on yet another set of travels on Sunday night, but my observation is close to what John suggests, and it does preclude what said. But my megahertz, to pick the example, that they actually have a crystal filter in that high IF.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's in mode, but or and none. And it's a crystal filter, and I have experience. I was in ICOM. They actually give you two or three options in the ICOM radios.
Because of the location you're in right now, they're only hearing you about 50% of the time, roughly 1 second on, 1 second off continuously, so we only got some of that message, but I am slowly getting the impression that the word roofing filter is not super clear, but I favor the very first IF network after the mixer is where the roofing filter frequently goes. That's my belief. And I'm willing to be corrected as we dig a little bit deeper into this one. So we're not 100% sure. Well, we'll give them half a prize on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Dick, I found a definition on Wikipedia, KC2QIQ.
Fire away, Glenn.
Yeah, okay, this is the definition as per Wikipedia. A roofing filter is a type of filter used in an HF radio receiver. It's usually found after the first receiver mixer. The goal of the roofing filter is to limit the passband of the first intermediate frequency IF stage, KC2QIQ, via Wikipedia.
Right, and that's why I said it's a crystal filter, Dick.
Okay, that comes fairly close to what I've been saying. I didn't think it included, in the general case, digital signal processing and fast Fourier transform, or selectable bandpass filters up front in the RF. That's not called the roofing filter. So we're slowly zeroing in on what we think is the definition, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
There's more to this if you want, and it does include DSP, Dick.
Fast enough to do that. It's 70 bigger.
Yeah, individual manufacturers are now going to be followed. The so-called analog
high-quality, maybe crystal roofing filter. They're going to be following it with all kinds of other fancy DSP that enhances that effect. But one of the biggest crimes that I've ever experienced